I'm unable to be on video because of a technical problem, as indicated last time, but we are attending to it. So I'll talk to you without you seeing me. As we are aware, we have got two presenters today. I had a call last night from the PLO of the minister who was proposing to start, but unfortunately there was a breakdown of communication. So we could not effectively change that. We'll have to start with the Department of Agriculture, Land Reform and Rural Development. Can I note any apologies, Secretary?
Chairperson, Mr. Paulson.
Okay,
can you hear me? Mr. Paulson?
Yes, I can. Yeah.
And Honorable Singh will leave at 10 for another meeting.
Yeah.
And the Deputy Minister?
Yes, I can hear you.
You can hear me? Yes.
Yes. Is that all?
That's all, Chair.
Okay, thank you very much. Welcome, Honorable Members and officials from the Department of Agriculture, Land Reform, Rural Development, as well as those who might be from Environment, Forestry and Fisheries. Welcome to the Honorable Members. I have been given the name of Mr. Molefe. The DG apologized from that department. He has got another commitment. So welcome, Mr. Molefe, and your team. Can I welcome you and say those that you see are members of the Portfolio Committee. I'm the chairperson, Fikile Xhosa. You can't see me, but I'm human like those that you can see. All we want is information, and I think then we'll engage from there. Can I hand over to you, Mr. Molefe?
Good morning, honorable members, and thank you, Chairperson. I would think that, I'm not sure whether Mr. Ramaswamy, the DDG, has already joined so that he could lead the introduction, and then I'll take over. So maybe as per protocol, because he's senior to me, if he's online, then he can take over from me. But if he's not available, then I can start. I
He hasn't joined, Mr. Molefe.
Okay, all right.
He's also not in the waiting room.
Oh, okay. All right. Thanks, honorable members. So I'll take you through the presentation. My name is Mphani Molefe, and I am the director responsible for veterinary public health in the Department of Agriculture, Land Reform and Rural Development. And my responsibilities include the meat safety under the Meat Safety Act, and also animal welfare under Animals Protection Act and Performing Animals Protection Act. And I think this is why we are meeting today, to see the link between the two, the Meat Safety Act, how it links with welfare and also with wildlife. So this would be the basis that we have prepared today. Thanks, members. I'll then take you through my presentation. The table of contents, I'll just talk to basically the Act itself, and maybe questions may come up, you know, on the basis of the presentation. So firstly, we looked at what the honorable members requested for us to prepare.
No, that's fine.
In as much as we were not very clear on what exactly honorable members would like to understand in terms of the implications of the Meat Safety Act.
I'm going to call you, Baba.
We thought that would be as broad as possible so that we can then cover all aspects that honorable members would like to know. And then, you know, if anything we had not covered, then we would be able to respond on it. The purpose of the Act is, of the Meat Safety Act, is to provide for measures to promote meat safety and safety of animal products and to establish and maintain essential national standards in respect of abattoirs. And honorable members would know that the constitution of a country allows government to set essential national standards that will then cover the whole country. If honorable members may know that the veterinary services is a concurrent function with provinces, therefore, in order to be able to put up a system that will be applicable consistently throughout the country, then you'd have to put up essential national standards. And this is what the Act seeks to achieve. It also regulates the importation and exportation of meat and establishments of meat safety schemes, whereby there would be a scheme that would be able to address a specific area. That scheme can be set up and then it will be implemented across the country. And also any other matter that is related to meat safety, the Act would then be able to cover that. Now, going straight into the Act, because I think the crux of the Meat Safety Act, you know, besides what we have just talked about, its purpose, it's how it defines an animal. It doesn't have scientific definition of an animal, but then it lists animals and then it refers to a schedule called Schedule 1 at the end of the Act itself. So it says an animal is an animal as listed in the schedule. So any animal that is not listed under the Meat Safety Act is not regarded as an animal on the basis of the Act, so therefore the Act does not apply to that animal. And that is, you'll see as we go on with the presentation, that has some negative, you know, areas, and that is what we are trying to address at this point. Now, Section 2 of the Act then provides for the Minister to be able to end Schedule 1 and add any type of animal to determine that a specific section of this animal does not apply to any certain animal. So the minister has that authority to amend Schedule 1 and also then to make some exemptions. For example, if in one province, you know, there has to be a rule to the rest of the country, minister has that authority under the Act to be able to do that. Just quickly to show honorable members what we have under Schedule 1, and especially in relevant committee on environment, forestry and fisheries, we just listed the animals that are on the on Schedule 1 for game, and we have this list, these animals, blesbuck, blue, wildebeest, and the rest here. One thing that I would like honorable members to note is this one here, elephant. The elephant has always been in this Schedule 1 since the enactment of the Act, you know, way back in 2000. So we'll come to it later on as we engage on this. Sorry, Honorable Mas, for going backwards. Section 7 of the Act then makes a determination of, you know, what the Meat Safety Act, which forms the crux of the Meat Safety Act, which says that no person may slaughter an animal at any place other than an abattoir. And no person may permit the slaughter of an animal at any place under their control unless that place is an abattoir. And also, no person may sell or provide meat for human and animal consumption unless it has been slaughtered at an abattoir. And this is very, very important, honorable members, because what it means is that any meat that is on the shelf or even on a plate must have gone through an abattoir. And there's a reason why that has been put in, so that we can assure that that meat has gone through the processes of ensuring food safety. And as you can see, number C talks about selling, but it also talks about providing meat. Therefore, if you were to go to the Act and implement it as maybe as it states, it means I cannot give you a piece of meat that has not gone through an abattoir, because if you get sick, then the Act does not cannot then cover that. So this is as broad as it can go, but primarily we focus on meat that goes for sale. But you can understand, our members, there are cases where there's culling operations, and we have seen in provinces where provincial departments responsible for environment and conservation would then, and that meat will end up in a church, you know, somewhere in a organization, welfare organization, and that meat would not necessarily go through an abattoir, but that would be deviant to the provision of Section 7(1)(c) of the Act, because that meat should have gone through an abattoir. But then Section 2 then makes an exemption to say the section above, which is Section 1, does not apply to slaughter for own consumption or for cultural and religious purposes, because now that cannot be regulated easily, and therefore the Meat Safety Act has made an exemption on that. There will be other pieces of legislation and authorities that would then be able to then regulate this sphere. For own consumption, we're also then dealing with Department of Health under the Foodstuffs, Cosmetics and Disinfectants Act, and local municipalities would then control how own consumption will then be carried out, you know, in their communities. For cultural and religious purposes, we have the CRL Commission that would then enter this sphere if there's anything that has to be regulated. But then the one thing that is important is that even though there's provision for exemption for own consumption, cultural and religious purpose, that meat that has been obtained under this provision may not be sold to any person. So if that meat is under the umbrella of own consumption, cultural or religious purposes, it may not be sold. It will only be, you know, consumed, you know, under, you know, a common, you know, a sharing or something like that, but not to enter the market. Then Section 11 of the Act then talks to essential national standards that I talked about, you know, earlier under the purpose of the Act. Now, what is relevant to the Portfolio Committee is the three sections that we have listed here. An animal presented for slaughter at an abattoir must be handled humanely. Now, that covers all the way from loading, transportation, you know, all the way up to killing. That animal must be handled humanely under the prescripts or requirements of the Animals Protection Act. And then Section 11I then talks to also what you can bring into an abattoir. It says no dead animal, an animal suffering that may be presented at an abattoir for slaughter. Now, this is very important, because when you look at game animals are brought into an abattoir dead. They are shot out in the field and then loaded onto an animal's onto a vehicle and brought into an abattoir. Now, in this, when you look at it, then means the Act would not be able to cover game animals. But then Section 12 then provided the minister the authority to then make an exemption and therefore to be able to allow game animals to fit in within the prescripts of the Meat Safety Act. An exemption had to be made for game animals, you know, to be exempted from Section 11A on the basis that they are brought in dead into an abattoir. So that exemption is there. It has been made by the minister. Therefore, game animals are able to enter the abattoir. And then Section 11J then talks to the inspection of the meat. Any animal presented for slaughter must be examined by a person contemplated in paragraph C. And that talks to a meat inspector or a registered inspector, as we call in the Act. And you can see the picture at the bottom that emphasizes that area, that the animal has to be inspected prior to slaughter, and also after it's converted into meat, there has to be an inspection, and then it will get a stamp of approval to then render it fit for animal and human consumption. Now, honorable members, we earlier talked about Schedule 1 of the Act, which lists animals to which the Act applies. And on the 28th of February 2020, the Minister then published a draft amendment to the Act, to Schedule 1, which aims at expanding the list. But then before I go into that, this was published in the Government Gazette, and then giving 60 days within which the public could comment. Then lockdown then started March, I think, 27th. And then noted that most citizens would have had time to then read through what is on the government gazette. And therefore, we extended the commenting period from the 28th of February until the 30th of June. And we believe that that gave the public enough time to then comment. So the closing date was extended from 2 months after the 28th of February to the end of June, actually, June 30th, June 2020. Now, what does the amendment seek to achieve? By the inclusion of additional animals in the schedule, is to achieve the following: to ensure that any animal that is slaughtered for human consumption is slaughtered in a humane manner, and the slaughter is conducted in a hygienic manner. So we're trying to achieve those two outcomes, you know, humane slaughtering of animal welfare, and that the meat is hygienic and safe for human consumption. No meat that is unsafe for human consumption may enter the commercial market. So we are trying to achieve that as well. And the next bullet then talks about the listing of animals in the schedule does not indicate the animals that may be slaughtered, but ensures that if such an animal is to be slaughtered, it should be done in a prescribed manner. And this is one of the issues that may have caused confusion when we published that draft amendment, because most public members thought we are actually prescribing which animals may be slaughtered. But this is not what the Act seeks to achieve. The Act does not determine which animals may be consumed. That is not under the prescripts or the authority of the Act. What the Act says is that if this animal is slaughtered for human consumption, that has to be done in a way that it will ensure humane humane manner in which it is slaughtered, and that the meat is slaughtered in a hygienic manner. So it doesn't necessarily say by including an animal, we are not saying that it must be slaughtered. What we are saying is that if it is slaughtered, then it should be slaughtered in this particular manner. So the decision, as you can see in the next bullet, we're saying the decision on which animals may be slaughtered for human consumption does not fall under this Act. So that can be done under the Animals Protection Act if it's for animal welfare reasons, but if it's for other reasons, then there should be other pieces of legislation that would then ban the slaughter of this particular animal, but is not in the Meat Safety Act. So now the absence of an animal in the schedule means that animal can be slaughtered for human consumption without having to comply with the provisions of the Act. And this is important. We get inquiries on people saying, for example, there's honorable members, I know you are also dealing with the lion in captivity issue. Now, one of the questions that we have received is that lion meat and lion bones are exported out of the country and end up in countries where they consume that now, or they make lion broth from the bones and then consume that. So we were then asked, what are you doing? Why are you exporting this for human consumption? And we are saying, because a lion is not an animal under the Meat Safety Act. Therefore, we have no jurisdiction of what anybody is doing with the livestock. For whatever reason, the Act would not be able to then cover that to make sure that if it's done, it's done properly. So that is what the limitations of the Act is. Animal. We also know that there's a lot of cases where dogs have been slaughtered, you know, for consumption. We have seen it in the media where even some churches, you know, people have been feeding, you know, members of the church, you know, dog meat. And then we have also been asked as to what are you doing as agriculture? And unfortunately, because a dog has not been listed as an animal, therefore the Meat Safety Act does not apply to it. So you'll only then rely on the local municipality under the foodstuffs and cosmetics to then regulate that. But there's very limited, you know, provisions that they have in terms of limiting that. So that is what we are trying to achieve with this, to broaden it so that we are able to then to control any animal that may enter the food chain. And even if it's not listed, then we'll be able to then cover it with the current draft. The inclusion of animals listed atop in the schedule does not exempt them from provision of conservation legislation. And this is also one thing that was raised by a lot of members of the public in terms of why are you then bypassing conservation legislation? We are not bypassing conservation legislation. If I can then address honorable members, skip bullet two, go to bullet three, I'll then go back to bullet two. It says for a top animal to be slaughtered for human consumption, permission under the relevant conservation legislation will have to be granted first before they can be slaughtered under the Meat Safety Act. For the in that and the necessary under, and then that is when it slaughtered under the Meat Safety Act conservation legislation. Now, it has always been this particular animal. Why not including this particular animal? Now, the middle book talks to that to say there are instances where top animal for various reasons, including conservation reasons, where there's or environmental reasons where there could be overgrazing, for example, in a particular way to then reduce the environment would be to cull those animals. Now, if those animals are to the meat, and there are instances where the game reserve would then avail that meat to the local community for consumption. Now, that under the current system, if that animal is not listed under the Act, it becomes an illegal activity. That meat should not end up on anybody's plate if that animal is not listed under the Meat Act. There are also reasons for health reasons for culling animals. There are also welfare reasons and other reasons. So that is what we are trying to say, that we are not encouraging the slaughter of top animals, but we are saying if that has to be done for various reasons that I've just talked to, that will then have to be done under, you know, a controlled environment that ensures humane or the welfare of the animals is taken into consideration, and also that there's a food safety that becomes the crux as well. Now, we also then made the emphasis that the elephants and hippopotamuses are already listed in there. Now, these two animals have always been there since the enactment of the Act in the year 2000. Now, what we are trying to emphasize, because we have had, you can see honorable members in the media, people are saying, you know, the Department of Agriculture is so cruel, is including elephants, is going to encourage people to eat elephants. And that is not what we are saying, because now elephant has always been there. So we are not including it. It has always been there. But what we are trying to say is to say the fact that an elephant has always been in the Act there hasn't been a rampant increase in the slaughter of this animal and the hippopotamus since 2000. So therefore, the inclusion of other animals may not result in an increased slaughter of these animals, because it hasn't happened to an elephant, you know, and we are thinking that, you know, it would not happen to other, you know, species that we are adding. But then a lot of work will also, we admit, that have to be done in terms of maybe conscientizing, you know, the public on, you know, what we are trying to achieve with this act, jointly with Department of Environment, Forestry and Fisheries. And therefore, we have set up a working in Beth and Dalrat to consider the concerns that are raised by the inclusion of TOPS animals in the draft amendment. And that working group will then advise us as to maybe we could phrase it differently, but, you know, with the aim of achieving the outcome that that we desire, to be able to control much more animals than we currently do. But there could be a way that we are rephrasing it, and that will get from the working group once they've concluded their work on the draft amendment. And in conclusion, honorable members, the intention of the amendment of Schedule 1 is to ensure that any animal slaughtered for human consumption is slaughtered with the applicable laws of the country that governs the safety and animal welfare. And finally, all activities dealing with animals must consider the welfare of the animals and comply with the Animals Protection Act. And this has also been made clear by the Concord in the ruling by Judge Kolapen, that in any work or activity that is done, you know, that relates to animals, animal welfare becomes, you know, a consideration that has to be factored in. Thank you, honorable members, for giving us time to present. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Mr. Molefe and your team. Honorable members, I think now it's your turn to raise questions for clarity, for whatever.
Chairperson,
so you are number one, Honorable Winkler.
Singh.
Honorable Singh. Who else is there? Yeah, maybe then let's start with the questions. Honorable Winkler.
Okay, thank you. Thank you so much for the presentation. I have a number of points which I require clarity on, as well as some suggestions and then some questions. My suggestion is that if the intent and motivation behind the amendment to Schedule 1 of the Meat Safety Act is not to encourage the wide-scale intensive farming and breeding of threatened and protected species for consumption, then perhaps that should be a caveat in the amendment. So it says that this would apply to animals that are culled, say for instance, as you had made mention of, but that this does not apply or authorize any intensive commercial breeding of threatened or protected species for human consumption. And I think that that will clarify what the motivation behind this amendment is to the general public as well. And it's a way to avoid the intimation that there's something going on about, you know, trying to commodify all our species, which South Africans have a huge personal and emotional investment serving and protecting. So you're going to have this consistent backlash unless you first suggestion. The second is with regards to the judgments by Judge Jody Colopin on the fact that welfare considerations have to be taken into consideration when you're implementing any legislation, because of the numerous concerns that have arisen out of the captive predator breeding industry. Now, I think that this is the concern. Many people think that when you now allow for slaughter of threatened and protected species for consumption, that the similar thing is going to happen that has happened with our captive predator breeding industry. And now you're going to have intensive breeding of giraffes and porcupines and rhino for their meat and derivative parts. And there's been too many welfare concerns already. The NSPCA had done an investigation and 92 farms, line farms, were found to have gross violations of animal welfare. And the department and the provinces do not So whose mandate would that in then essentially become if this is an unintended consequence of this amendment now? You know, who is going to take responsibility for the enforcement of animal welfare? Already not cope with that responsibility as it stands, and the mandate falls solely now on the NSPCA, which is not even funded by government and relies on public donations. I think if you can't control the industries that are currently in existence, our wildlife under similar conditions of vulnerability and threat of exploitation. So that's the other thing. Then my question is, if this is not to encourage the breeding, intensive breeding and farming of wildlife for consumption, then are we adding these animals to the list? I mean, where are we finding instances where people are eating giraffe and porcupines, etc.? So why is this necessary? Where are you finding instances where people are eating our threatened and protected species that this legislation or amendment is necessary? Because it comes in. Because trophy hunting, as you say, that could be for own consumption. Religious cultural practice, again, on consumption that's not being sold. Then the other issue that I had is there is a catch-all phrase at the bottom of the amendment which says that this also applies to all other species of animals not mentioned above, including birds, fish, and reptiles that may also be sorted for human and animal consumption. So why are some animals listed in this Schedule 1 inclusion and yet the balance of animals are just all included in this catch-all phrase, which is kind of like an addendum at the end of? What does this really imply for our wildlife? I'd like to know. Even though they're not in the schedule, this seems to include lions as well, if you're going to say all other animals. And you know we have massive concerns over the animal welfare, lions in captivity. Okay, sorry, just give me another moment. In terms of the legislation, the environmental legislation and the provincial legislation on top species, there is a way, and I would like the clarity on this, that this could possibly be circumvented is in terms of the Animal Improvement Act, when wildlife species were included in the Animal Improvement Act, they became livestock and no longer wildlife. So do the TOPS regulations still apply to animals, wildlife that is now considered livestock under the Animal Improvement Act? That's what I'd like to know. Because if that is so, then conservation and environmental legislation do not trump the Meat Safety Act amendment. And basically, any animal that's in that Animal Improvement Act can be bred commercially, and with the Meat Safety Act now in collaboration, can then be bred for human and animal consumption. So this is another question I would like answered. Thank you.
Honorable Singh.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson. Like I say, I might have to run across to Chief Woods Forum. But thank you very much, Mr. Molefa, for the presentation. I think, you know, the presentation sort of underlies or emphasizes the challenge between the conservation side and the meat side. Because my simple definition of animal is any organic matter that has a specialized sense and particular organs. So, you know, for me, a lion is an animal, a giraffe is an animal, chicken is an animal and so on and so forth. But I think I heard you say that there is discussion on the scheduling and the classification. And I think that's going to be very important for us moving forward, because certainly the exclusion, specific exclusion in the schedules of some of these animals, which are considered wildlife, does cause problems. And I think that consultation we've been told about by the minister, but we need to be very, very involved so we can get this sorted out once and for all, so we can preserve all animals from exploitation by anybody. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Molest, there's any responses you want to make?
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members, for comments and questions. And starting with, firstly, Honorable Winkler, we welcome the positive position that you have made in terms of how we can then attend to the challenges that have been raised by the public, and also the parliament has, you know, also raised some of the issues. So we really appreciate the constructive, you know, approach in terms of assisting us with reaching the desired outcome. And that clarification in terms of maybe phrasing it to put it clear that it only deals with the culling operations, or maybe has been listed for health reasons or something like that, that we can put in the provision so that it becomes very clear as to what we're trying to achieve. And I think, Honorable Members, I'm not sure if members received a clarificatory notice that was then issued after the drafting. We can make it available to Honorable Members, which then provides a detailed clarification. Unfortunately, it wasn't issued with the release of the draft for public comments, but that was released, I think, a month thereafter, which then talks to everything that I've talked to today. It is contained in that. So we may be able to then bring in some of those aspects into the schedule itself to make it clear as to what is the intention. And if that becomes the, you know, the approved way to deal with it, then it will then be clear as to which animals, even though they are listed, which of those listed animals, under which conditions will the act then cover them, and then under which act, under which conditions will we then forbid those animals to then be slaughtered for human consumption. So that is something that we are working on with DEF, and will, you know, we appreciate the contributions made. Now, on the issue of the responsibility for the control and implementation once this has been approved, we are, in addition to the NSPCA, the department itself, through the veterinary services systems that we have in the country, we are also doing our best to monitor the implementation of the Animals Protection Act. In as much as it's not spelled out in the Animals Protection Act itself, but as Honorable Member said, the Judge Colapen ruling, it also then assists us to can then compel, even outside of the Act itself, to compel our officials to implement its provision whenever they are dealing with animals. So when our state veterinarians are handling animals on farms, they have to also consider animal welfare. When the animals enter the abattoir, they have to be dealt with in a way that emphasizes animal welfare. And that is done through officials that are responsible for implementation of, you know, all veterinary services legislation. So that will be done by those officials. But then we are also then still drafting various pieces of legislation, you know, to then clarify further animal welfare requirements. And one of them is we are working on regulations on any issue that we have noted has not been clearly identified in the animal Protection Act. You know, the Animal Protection Act is a very old legislation, and one of the intentions is to actually rescind it and replace it with a new animal welfare bill. Now, what we are then doing is, in the meantime, because that may take years to come on and then be assented to, so what we are then working on is regulations, and one regulation would then be able to then bring in the aspect of monitoring of this provision if it gets approved by the minister. Now, the issue of the addendum or rider at the bottom of the draft amendment, that we actually had a lot of discussion as to, there are two ways of doing it. Either you list every animal on earth, or you go the way we did it. And it is impossible to list every animal on earth, because that will become a 100-page document. But then what we then did was, in as much as we have listed animals, but then there could be another animal that is not included there. For example, if somebody was to end up somewhere in the middle of South Africa with an animal that is not listed there, what then do we do as agriculture? If it's not there, we can't do anything. And then there will be an outcry that agriculture is not doing anything about this. So we then made that provision to say, if any other animal ends up on somebody's plate, it has to go through the Meat Safety Act. And now we also then received a comment from a member of the public to say, it's ridiculous to have a list, but also then ultimately say any other animal. But then the legal opinion on that is that a list is a list. Schedule, according to the definition in the Act itself, it talks to a list being a list. And therefore, if you only then say under definition, an animal is as listed in Schedule A, in Schedule 1, and then you go to Schedule 1, and then it only gives you that rider to say all animals, that then it doesn't become a list, and therefore it doesn't comply with what the Act says. So we were forced, if I may say, to then have a list, but also then we tried to also cover any aspect of any loophole that may be there if we don't list all animals, which is impossible to do. Do top animals registered under Animal Improvement Act also have, if I may rephrase what Honourable Member is saying, that all animals that are listed under Animal Improvement Act, are they also regulated under TOPS? Unfortunately, I am not responsible for Animal Improvement Act, Honourable Members, but my understanding, I'm not sure if Mr. Mamabolo is presently on the in the meeting, who's the registrar responsible for Animal Improvement Act, but he may come in if he's available. But my understanding is that the two pieces of legislation would be able to then run concurrently, that there shouldn't be any contravention of either. You know, even though this animal then becomes a livestock, if you may call it that, but it must still be done in a way that it doesn't contravene the TOPS regulations. And this will only be done with collaboration between the two regulators, DEF and DALRAT, working together to make sure that there's no areas of concern, you know, on either side. So that's my response to that. And finally, Honorable Singh, we appreciate your input as well. And you emphasized the issue of collaboration, the working team working on a way to harmonize, you know, the whole matter and come up with an outcome that we'll all be able to live with. And we really appreciate that, your presence. Thank you very much. Thanks, Chairperson.
Thank you. Is there no follow-up?
Yes, please, Chairperson, Honourable Winkler.
Honourable Winkler, yeah.
Thank you for those responses. What I'd like, again, clarity on is when the catch-all phrase, all other species of animals, birds, fish, also apply to this amendment, does this include lions? I need this answer very clearly, please. Does this include Lyme? And since you can't provide a comprehensive schedule or list of animals that are included in the Meat Safety Act, perhaps then a list of animals that are excluded from the Meat Safety Act would make more sense if you are worried about it being too voluminous. And then I asked about why was the Meat Safety Act amendment originally pitched to your department? Because it only makes sense if there have been numerous instances where threatened and protected species are being butchered and then their meat being sold. So I just want to know what precipitated this amendment. Where have we had instances of the sale of and consumption of threatened and protected species that we need this amendment? Then I'm quite concerned that the Animal Improvement Act, that you are uncertain as to how this feeds in with the amendment to the Meat Safety Act, because throughout the entire presentation, you had emphasized that at no point does the Meat Safety Act amendment trump environmental and provincial environmental legislation. And that is going to be the safeguard against the mass commercial and intensive breeding of wildlife for consumption. But that whole argument becomes null and void if animals that are included in the Animal Improvement Act, which includes threatened and protected species, are no longer regulated by the TOPS regulations. So the fact that this isn't a huge red flag and hasn't been considered before this amendment had been gazetted is very concerning to me, because I think this is the main issue here, is how are we going to afford protection to our wildlife, to our threatened and protected species? So that's the other question. And then the last one is, you said that the NSPCA, alongside the other veterinary services from the state, they monitor animal welfare. The problem is that we have seen that in many factory farming situations, in many abattoirs, there are gross animal welfare concerns. And unfortunately, the department and the NSPCA do not, and this is factual, do not have enough resources to ensure that animal welfare considerations and the Animal Protection Act is adhered to. We've seen this, as I said again, with the captive predator breeding industry. There have been too many, numerous cases of neglect and gross animal welfare violations. Now, if we're using that as a benchmark to see whether or not we can effectively regulate these industries, then it becomes evident that it has been poorly regulated. We don't have the resources, and so prevention here would be better than cure. We know, we've been down this road. We understand what happens. We don't have the resources to enforce this. So why now add a whole host of other threatened and protected species to the mix that also cannot be properly regulated? Thank you.
Thank you.
Sorry.
Yes.
Chairperson, just one more follow-up thing. Yeah. Chairperson, from the presentations, we heard there are different acts, the Meat Safety Act, Animal Improvement Act, Animal Production Act. We have a particular mandate as conservation. So I'd just like to ask Mr. Molefe, where do we go to from here? We know there have been amendments. We know there were public comments, but we need to do something to regularize this matter as far as conservation is concerned. And what steps is he going to be proposing in that regard that can be confirmed with the ministers? Thank you.
Thank you. No other hand, yes? So this is the last now, Mr. Molefe. You can respond.
Thank you very much, Chairperson and honorable members, for the questions and inputs. The first question on whether this provision includes lions. The simple answer is yes, it does include lions. And I've talked to this earlier when I was talking to export of lion bones. as recent as I think late last year, we had that inquiry that that's when the issue of a lion bone quota, you know, became, you know, a very serious issue, a topical issue. And then we had a submission saying, but you are agriculture, you are allowing these animals to be exported to these particular countries. And as a result, whenever, when they arrive on the other side, the people on the other side then boil these bones to make lion broth, and then it becomes something that they drink. And you will note that these animals are killed using tranquilizers, you know, in some instances. And therefore, people then actually consume a tranquilizer and may die, you know. And therefore, what are you agriculture doing about it? Now, in the absence of having a lion listed, you know, under the Meat Safety Act, therefore, we cannot enter that sphere. If somebody was to eat a lion, we can't do anything about it. The only people that can do anything about it would then be Department of Health. Now, so that's why the inclusion of a lion in that provision. Then we'll also, in addition to safeguarding the welfare of the animal, because that will be done under an environment that will be regulated, but in the people who may end up eating the meat of that lion or drinking that broth made of those bones will be assured, you know, the safety, food safety, because tranquilizers would not be allowed in the slaughter of that lion if it's intended for human consumption. So that's the reason. But I still want to emphasize that we are not therefore encouraging that people should then raise real lions in captivity for this purpose. But we are saying if it happens, then let it be done in a way that, you know, ensures animal welfare and food safety. Now, the other question, you know, relating to why not, instead of listing animals to which the Act applies, why not then put a list of animals to which the Act does not apply? I think that's a legal matter, because the Act clearly says that an animal is as listed in the schedule. Therefore, in order for us to do that option, we'll then have to change the Act itself, to change how that is defined, and that will be a possibility. But in my thinking is that we will also have a very long list even of animals that are excluded. But if that is a shorter list, then it will have to be preceded by the amendment of the Act itself to afford the minister to can also then publish a list of animals that are excluded under the Act. So that is something that we thought it's easier than to work with what we currently have, instead of then amending the Act, and then which may take a number of years and we would not achieve a quicker outcome on what we seek to achieve. Now, the question that Honorable Winkler is raising also in terms of what precipitated this amendment, I've just given an example of lions, which is one of those instances that, you know, we have noted. And it's not only last year when we noted this. Lions are being slaughtered, and you end up with the bones being consumed in a form of broth. And also giraffes. Yes, giraffes have been, we have pictures that we can share with honorable members, where giraffes are being culled in game reserves. And what happens is they call, you know, the members of the community surrounding the game parks and then donate that meat to them. Now, as we are saying, that is illegal currently, because the Meat Safety Act forbids that process from being done. Now, we are trying to regularize that and to make it legal that if that meat is to be donated to the community surrounding, or any community, that has to be done in a way that is legal. So that's the reason why we are doing this. So we have cases that are clear on this, where this has happened. Now, I've talked to the issue of Animal Improvement Act and TOPS working together, and my thinking is that the current collaborations between DALRAT and DEF, you know, would be able to then close any possible loopholes in terms of any area that has not been covered, you know, either when we when the animals are listed under Animal Improvement Act and also have to be regulated under TOPS. And this is not, I think we need to make it clear that the Animal Improvement Act and the Meat Safety Act are not the same piece of legislation, and therefore listing of animals under Schedule 1 does not have anything to do with listing of animals under the Animal Improvement Act. And therefore, so the Meat Safety Act, when we amended, when we drafted the amendment, we did not necessarily consider whether that animal is listed under Animal Improvement Act or not. We were just looking at the general principle of Animal Improvement Act or not, but then we are just making overall provision for, you know, the consumption of wild and game animals. In terms of resources, as to how can we then regulate that, I think the argument that has always been advanced in terms of when people draft legislation is there's an argument as to whether is it wise to make a regulation or a law that you cannot enforce or leave it without making it and allow anybody to do what they want to do. So you have to think, which side do you go? If you don't have enough resources, do you still want to regulate their sphere and ensure that, you know, there is provision for conformity in that sphere? Or otherwise you say, because I don't have resources, I'm not going to enter this sphere. And then you may end up with an uncontrolled environment where everybody and anybody does what they want, and there is nobody that can then enter that field because there's no law that forbids that from being done. So we thought that it would better, in as much as we may not have enough resources, and I don't think we'll ever have enough resources in any, in a lot of other government areas, we are, you know, having challenges in terms of resources. But it is important that you put a legislation that will control that field. And also then the other way of then ensuring compliance to that law is public awareness. Instead of just working on the law enforcement, it is also very critical to do public awareness. And if you do a very good job in public awareness, that then cuts half of your challenges, that, and then with the limited resources that you have, then you can then put them in terms of enforcement of the act. So that is the approach that we are going to take, and we have been taking, you know, and in enforcing our legislation. And going to Honorable Singh's comment as to where from here, as we have said, Honorable members, we are collaborating, the DALRAD is collaborating with DEF, with officials in DEF, and the working group is working on that list. And the outcome of the two departments in terms of the correct way of phrasing it, and if there's a very strong point as of saying that we must abandon that, we will consider that. And that will then be tabled through the relevant authorities, and including the ministers, to say this is something that the two departments technical officials have looked at, therefore the ministers will then have to make a decision at the end of the day. Having noted the comments that we received from the public, having also then noted the comments from honorable members here, and also what we see in the media sphere in terms of the concerns, after having looked at that and having attended to that, then we'll then pitch it to honorable ministers to then make a determination thereafter. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Molefe and the team. I'm sure we are better than when we started as members of the Portfolio Committee in terms of information. But yes, equally, I think you still want to say something?
Yes, Chairperson. Wait, yes. On the group, Mr. Mama Bolo from the Animal Production in the department is available to talk us through the Animal Improvement Act and how it relates to this. Could we give him an opportunity, please?
Are you asking for him, or is he asking for that?
He's asked on the group chat.
Chairperson.
Oh, okay.
Chair.
Yeah.
It's Minister Creasy here.
Yeah.
Chairperson.
Honorable Minister.
Good morning. Good morning, Chair, and good morning to the committee members. Chair, I had sent you a message that I have a cabinet subcommittee meeting at 11 this morning, and I would really like an opportunity to present our presentation on waste before I have to go to that meeting. So if we could do that, please, Chair, I would appreciate it.
Okay. Honorable Singh.
Yeah, Chairperson, thank you very much. I'm glad to see the minister on, and I think we should grant her that opportunity. But I wonder if the minister can give us some kind of a comfort that on this matter of the Meat Safety Act and animal welfare, that as she had told us before, there will be continued discussions between the two ministries, the two departments, and obviously the two portfolio committees, so we can resolve the conflict between animal welfare and meat safety and animal protection, etc. Thank you.
Okay. No, this is what I was going to say. I think let me intervene now. This is what I was going to say, at least you have got something out of the presentation. There might be gaps, like what Mr. Mambavolo was going to say, but I was indicating that the two ministers, even ourselves as the two committees, we have not met. So we are thanking the officials for the presentation, but I think it is just something that is starting a process that will help us to call in touch. If there are any gaps, the ministers would be able to take us through that. And I'm trying to say, let's not exhaust everything today. Even if Mr. Mambavolo was going to say, the minister did request to present first, but unfortunately, there was no time to communicate that to the other team. But thank you very much, Mr. Molefe, and your team. I think we'll have to move now to the other presentation. Yes, can I hear the voice?
It's Honorable Winkler.
Yeah.
The crux of this, the Meat Safety Act amendment, is actually now contingent basically upon what the Animal Act classifies threatened or protected species as. And I feel that this would be a completely wasted opportunity if we didn't give Mr. Mambavolo the opportunity to just very briefly speak to this. It will take no more than 5 minutes. He's already here. This has been set aside months ago, and I think that it's only fair that we try to resolve this as far as we can with the relevant officials here today. So if I could just beg, please, your indulgence here, and just 5 minutes, whether or not our wildlife is protected by TOPS regulations that are included in the Animal Improvement Act.
Mr. Mambavolo, can you take less than 5 minutes? Can I hand over to you?
Good morning, everybody. Thank you, Chair. Thanks, members of the committee. Given this space, I should indicate that my name is Joel Mambavolo. I'm the registrar and the director for Animal Improvement Act. The listing of the animals.
Okay, just message me.
The listing of animals under Animal Improvement Act, it has more to do with ownership of these animals, not by the farmers in South Africa, but as a country. A classical, a real example is the issue of the name Bafana Bafana. You would recall, sometimes in 2011, the national team nearly lost the name Bafana Bafana. If South Africa does not register these animals, it will lose its sovereignty over these animals. It will lose intellectual ownership of these animals. Therefore, the listing of animals is of national importance. And this listing is complementary to the existing legislations like the COPS, like the Meat Safety Act, in that South Africa cannot claim to have a buffalo meat if it doesn't own the animal buffalo. So it's an issue of national importance, irrespective of whether the animals are threatened or not. And this listing also assists the Meat Safety Act and the animal welfare, in that it is not the government that is farmed, that is farming, but it's the farmers who farm. But how would the government be able to pin down all those people who ill-treat the animals? So it has to be a complementary matter between the farmers and the government. But all in all, the listing has to do with sovereignty on ownership of these animals by the government of South Africa. And I must indicate, Chair, that in all 54 AU member states, South Africa is the only country that has listed these animals as their own. Tomorrow, a certain country may claim ownership of these animals, like it happened with the Boer goats. At some stage, certain countries claimed ownership of Boer goats. The issue of Hoodia, these are all related. And until South Africa recognizes the listing of these animals, then we cannot claim ownership of these animals. This is, in short, why these animals are listed under the Animal Improvement Act. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think we won't allow questions now. Maybe next time we'll have more time. Can we now, with your permission, move to the next presentation? Honorable Minister and the team, can I hand over to you?
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and good morning to the honourable members once again. I think I would just want to start by saying to Honourable Singh that I have had a meeting with Minister Dadiza. I have raised with her in that meeting the concerns of the department and also the concerns of the portfolio committee with regard to these regulations. Following on that meeting, we have set up a joint task team to ensure that matters pertaining to the environment and the protection of threatened species need to be factored into the way in which these regulations are crafted. Because we are of the opinion that the TOPS regulations take precedence with regard to threatened species. So I have brought this matter to her attention and we have set up the working group. With regard to welfare matters, this is an issue which is currently under consideration, because what the honourable members understand is, at law, at present, welfare falls within the domain of the Minister of Agriculture. But there are a whole range of issues which honourable members are fully conversant with that pertain to the welfare of animals in the environmental sphere. And accordingly, we are seized with the issue as to how we can give expression to that judgment which Judge Colopin had delivered. So I think that it's just, I think what one would want to say is that we share the concerns with the committee. We have brought these concerns to the attention of the committee, and independently of that process, we are looking into what regulatory amendments would be necessary to empower me to engage in welfare matters where these matters overlap with my portfolio. So I think if I would want to to leave it there. I would then want to move on, honourable members, to the subject of today, which is how we are dealing with plastic waste. And our acting DDG, Mamohala Musekeni, has a briefing for you. I think that what honourable members know is that last year we had a plastics colloquium where we worked together with the industry, with civil society, with the waste reclaimers and with other interested parties to try and put together a comprehensive program to deal with the issue. We are now at the point where we can report back to you on progress that we have made. And I would now want to hand over Ms. Musekeni to deliver the presentation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Minister, Honourable Chairperson, Honourable Members. I'll be taking you through the presentation. That relates to plastics, the products that are made from the plastic material are inexpensive, they are very lightweight, and they are also durable materials. And this makes popular in terms of being used in a wide range of applications. And that also consequently results in most generated from this plastic product, and some of which, because of the lightweight, also become part of the plastic litter. And they end up in the environment and also in our waterways, and also gets to the marine environment, which currently is a huge concern globally, and that is also a concern for us here in the country. But in addition, with regard to households accessing refuse removal services from municipalities, it's not all households. Approximately a quarter of households do not receive these services, so in line with our national domestic waste collection standards. And this reality also exacerbates illegal dumping and also having a lot of materials that are made of plastic being a part of the litter. Then just reflecting on our legislative framework that is in place to protect the environment, of course, we have the overarching legislation, which is our Constitution, Section 24, which provides for the protection of the environment and also for citizens to enjoy an environment that is not harmful to their health and well-being. But I would like to emphasize that we do have the NEMA as well, National Environmental Management Act. But for purposes of this briefing, I would just emphasize those legislative framework that are relevant to plastics. In 2003, we did publish the plastic bag regulations from this department, but also from the National Treasury, we do have a plastic bag levy, which is applicable to plastic carrier bags. And linked to that, because we needed to also, through the Department and Competition, regulate this plastic bag products that are put onto the market, the SABS developed the SENS 695, which is applicable to plastic carrier bags. And to ensure that the SENS is also enacted and it's enforced it needed to be taken through a process of making a compulsory specification, which the DTIC published for implementation, 87, which is currently being administered by the National Regulator of Compulsory Specifications, and that controls the plastic carrier bag. And of emphasis, where we are currently in 2020, last month we have just received a cabinet-reviewed national waste management strategy. And also in this financial year, the department also has published the proposed amendments to regulations, which I'll talk briefly on later on. And also propose the extended producer responsibility regulations, together with three notices, one that focuses on some of this single-use plastic, mainly packaging, and some of the other paper products. But also the other Section 18 notice focuses on lighting products, as well as electrical and electronic equipment. And Minister referred to the plastic colloquium, the first that was held in November last year. It provided a platform where representatives from the three spheres of government, the private sector and civil society were able to engage and are continuously engaging on making sure that there are effective partnerships to enhance the management of plastic waste. And the discussions also promoted a sustainable management of plastic waste in the country. We've also created a platform where information is exchanged with regard to best practice, as well as identifying and addressing bottlenecks with regard to the management of plastic in the country. Opportunities that relate to the economy as it relates to plastic were identified. And also of key importance is also the transitioning of the informal economy, mainly characterized by the waste pickers and informal collectors that are visible in our waste recycling space. Key importance that relates to the delivery of services, role and responsibilities of municipalities, effective delivery of waste services. Also the technologies that are practical and that are affordable with regard to plastic waste management were also are part of the ongoing plastic colloquium engagement. And circular economy is key with regard to the management of plastic waste, even before it becomes waste. Design of this plastic product, the concept of the cradle to cradle was for that column plastic waste the circular. And just to touch on the key decisions coming from the plastic, a key commitment being that of a plastics master plan for the country, which clearly define the role of plastics in circular economy. I must indicate that it's an ongoing process. This process has started. There have been engagement of the country with regard to the development of this plastics master plan. Is led by the Department of Trade, Industry and Competition. Also, the one key decision is the strengthening of waste collection services by municipalities, because most of this plastic pollution and plastic litter in the environment also indicates a gap with regard to the collection services. The recognition of the informal waste economy and its transition into the formal economy, I've mentioned the significant role played by the waste pickers and recognition of that role and also mainstreaming it in our legislative framework as well. One key area that is emerging is the compostable plastic products that are also being put onto the market, and there are also environmental claims linked to this product. So an issue being the standards that are applicable to this plastic product, and such that we are able to make consumers aware and ensuring that this labeling issues are taken care of. The awareness and communication issues are key, and hence a key decision was to have a strengthened use of media platforms to curb plastic pollution. The six working groups have been established and are continuously working on ensuring that the commitments made in the colloquium, as well as other emerging issues on plastic waste, are being addressed. Just to touch per working group, some of the key decisions, the working group on product standards and certification, which is also supported technically through the South African Bureau of Standards. The key decision there was to look into addressing the design of products to increase their recyclability, and knowing which materials are recyclable. And one key standard that is currently under review is the 695 on plastic bags, and it's also linked to the proposed amendment regulations on plastic carrier bags that I will brief you on the next slide. The product design and development and innovation working group also had a key decision on supporting the regulation and the guidelines to increase recycled content in packaging in order to support circularity. And to this day, packaging guidelines have been developed. That is one key progress coming from that working group. With regard to the integration of the informal waste economy, that working group, the key decision being collaboration with stakeholders to sustain the collective voice. And I think one key issue that we also saw as part of the lockdown was the support that came for waste pickers as well, which is also evident from the collaboration that has been strengthened. There's also a waste picker integration guideline which has been finalized and currently is being piloted in the city of Tshwane to support its further implementation. The biodegradable and compostable plastics working group guidelines that should be in place to ensure the responsible handling of these materials. Given that these compostable plastic products are currently being marketed and consumers are attracted to them, it's key that there is understanding that generally, the country still needs infrastructure, composting infrastructure that would support this product, and hence the management of this product also needs to be looked into. And currently, there has been an establishment of a Compostable Plastics Association, because there was a gap in terms of coordination in that specific sector. Hence, the association was a critical development, and it's there addressing some of the key actions that have been agreed on. The working group on infrastructure of key importance in the working group before I mentioned the composting infrastructure, but also with other plastic products that are manufactured from fossil fuels, you will need infrastructure to be able to make sure that there is collection, also there is a processing of that plastic waste into other new products as part of promoting circularity. Hence, the issues of buyback centers and other infrastructure that needs to be in place was a key decision. And one of the key progress that has been made is that potential sites for setting up plastic pelletization plants in order to increase the recycling of plastic waste has been finalized. The final working group on consumer education and awareness, it's key. The key decision was on ensuring that issues of education and awareness are mainstreamed as part of our education system, especially the basic education as part of the school curriculum. And there has been progress with regard to ensuring that the Good Green Deeds program also includes a school awareness and also working with other stakeholders and community-based organizations and private sector as well to ensure that awareness is raised. And engagements are also ongoing with the Department of Basic Education to ensure that the school curriculum also integrates waste education and awareness, but also the emphasis on plastic waste as well. The National Waste Management that has been approved has got three key pillars that are supposed to assist us with the management of waste. And the waste minimization being the first pillar, which talks to the prevention of waste, which aims at the designing of products so that they have the environment in mind, and they can also aim for circularity in that product design, which is part of the reduce, reuse as well, so that these products are not just produced for single applications, but could be reused and then recycling afterwards and could be recovered either for energy and also other alternative waste treatment is considered. The diversion target for the 5 years is 40%, and with specific targets for the other waste materials prioritized in the management of waste. The second pillar from the National Waste Management Strategy of key importance links with the provision of waste services to households and other users in the country, and that is key area that we are working with municipalities to ensure that all South Africans live in a clean surroundings. The third pillar is on compliance enforcement and awareness. We talked about awareness earlier on in terms of ensuring that issues of mainstreaming education in the mainstreaming waste management in the education system are attended to, but also general awareness that would also link up with labeling of products to be able to bring awareness to the consumers out there, but also in terms of the legislative regulatory framework that we've put in place, compliance monitoring of that and ensuring that there is enforcement for consequences where provisions are not met or there are offences. Going into the regulation that has been put in place, I must say that the amendment to the plastic bag regulation, it was published for public comments, and currently it's under the comments. There were engagements that were held. So in terms of the proposal that were in the published regulations, is that by January 2023, the plastic carrier bags that would be put onto the South African market need to be made from a minimum of 50% of post-consumer recyclate. So this is a product design target that we have put in place. It aims to promote the demand side of waste management, such that we encourage that the products that are on the market promote a circular economy, because they would have been designed or produced from materials that were generated as waste. So this approach in the amendments also goes up to 75% by January 2025 in terms of the product design of this plastic carrier bag, and then 100% by 2027. So that is it's a phase in schedule of the product design of the bags that we would want to see on the South African market. And in terms of its regulation compliance, the national regulator of compulsory specifications, an entity under the DTIC, will be assisting us with the monitoring of compliance, supported by the SABS in terms of the design, whether the bags have been designed in accordance with the regulation. The next aspect with regard to the proposed regulatory framework that we've put in place in this year is the extended producer responsibility approach. It's a policy approach that seeks to ensure that producers of products, those are the manufacturers, they take responsibility for their product, and this responsibility is extended towards the post-consumer stage. So currently, most products that are on the market, once the retailer has sold the product to you, their responsibility ends there. But with this policy, environmental policy approach, we are saying it should not end there. There should be measures that are put in place such that once a consumer has made use of the product, then those measures kick in to protect the environment from the waste that has arisen. So this is in our legislation under the National Environmental Management Waste Act, we are making sure that we are strengthening the environmental policy measures using this. And it also provides for an increase with regard to material recovery rates from specific waste streams that have been prioritized for this policy approach. And it also provides for funding from this manufacturers or producers, because then they will have to invest into the collection of materials once they have become waste. And it also provides for diversity in the policy mix that we are using, because then the municipalities also will have responsibility for residual waste, because then the manufacturers would also assist in the management of this post-consumer waste arising from their materials. And in terms of the process that we have followed for this extended producer responsibility, from Section 18, we were able to engage with the relevant stakeholders and develop a proposed Section 18 notices for the three sectors, paper, packaging, and some of the single-use products, the lighting, as well as the electrical and electronic equipment. These regulations were published for public comment on the 26th of June, and they were open for public comments for a period of 2 months. Initially, it was the first month, and stakeholders requested extension, and that the extension was granted. We also had it was virtual consultations that were had in addition to written submissions that were submitted to the department. And currently, the department is considering the comments as well as revising the notices and the regulations. And the plan, the target is to ensure that the notices, three notices as well as the EPR regulations are published for implementation in this financial year. And specifically going into the notice that is for paper, packaging and some single-use products, it provides its purpose provides for a requirement for producers to set up procedures, processes, and also the resourcing to implement EPR measures. And it contains the listed or the identified products wherein EPR would be applicable. It also provides the targets that would be applicable for those products. And these targets relate to product composition. In the earlier slides, the regulations that relate to plastic bags, there was that phase-in schedule of the recycled content, and that is what the product composition talks to. The targets also helps to collection, how much has to be collected from what the producer has put onto the South African market, and how much has to be reused, some of the products that could be reused, and that should be there, as well as recycling targets. And there are also specifications in terms of the persons that should implement the EPR measures. And the listed products include plastic packaging, biodegradable and compostable plastic packaging, single-use plastic products, and single-use compostable and biodegradable plastic products. And with regard to the EPR regulations in terms of what they provide for, the EPR measures include the provision that establish the scheme, or the producers can be able to implement their own scheme. So in the regulations provide for that, because currently in some of the sectors, there are existing voluntary EPR schemes that have been happening before the implementation of this regulatory or the compelling legislation that is will be put in place. The measures also provide for the financing of this extended producer responsibility scheme, because it will take money to ensure that there is collection, there is sorting, there is recycling, and there's also recovery of those identified products. And the regulations also set up a framework for reporting the media report as well as the annual performance reports, and these are in line with some of the governance standard practices that are applicable in the sector, in the sectors. Just for in terms of the next steps, the way forward, we will be we are prioritizing the implementation of the National Waste Management Strategy. And we are also strengthening the working group priorities, those six working groups where we are working with civil society and private sector and other stakeholders with regard to the key decisions. We will be strengthening also the implementation of the regulatory mechanisms. As I've said, we are finalizing the notices as well as the regulations that relates to EPR, but also on our plan for the next financial year, it's also to focus on other aspects that would promote the demand side of waste management, looking into promoting a green procurement, specifically the products that are produced from waste materials with a recycled content in them. Those would be strengthened, and also taking through some of the issues that relate to access to delivery of waste services with regard to supporting municipalities with regard to waste management services. We are strengthening that. Also, the campaign on anti-littering and education and awareness, the Good Green Deeds program, ensuring that it's implemented in all municipalities, and those consumers that are not compliant, that they are dealt with regard to compliance actions and enforcement. Thank you.
Honourable Minister, is that all?
Yes, Chairperson. I think that concludes our presentation. I think that we can take inputs from the committee. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Honourable members, it's your turn.
Honourable Minister,
get in the court? Honourable
Winkler.
Honourable Winkler. Who else? Is there any other member who would want to raise a question? Okay. Honourable Winkler.
Thank you for that comprehensive report, and thank you to the Minister as well. For giving us feedback on that plastic colloquium. What I'd like to ask is that our deadlines seem to be very accommodating to the plastics industry. If we look at the rest of Africa, we have about 34 countries that have implemented very progressive and plastic bans on single-use plastics at various phases of implementing these progressive plastic bans. 16 African countries have total bans on plastic. And I think that as South Africa, we should actually be setting a precedent. We should be the country that really sets this very progressive environmental legislation when it comes to single-use plastics. So I do think that we could be stricter on our timeline. I think that if other countries could have an outright ban within a year of single-use plastics, that giving the industry 10 years to reach 100% a post-consumer recyclist, I think it's a bit too accommodating. I think we're in the midst of a global ecological crisis. We have huge issues with marine plastic pollution. Our rivers across the country are heavily polluted with plastics. And I think it really does need some more urgent attention through our legislation. I think 10 years down the line, I think some of this might be irreversible, some of this environmental degradation caused by plastics. So I would ask the department and the minister to please look at those timelines and to act with a sense of urgency that this issue really does deserve. In terms of the extended producer responsibility plan, what sort of waste management plans have been discussed? Have we looked at models that are used in other countries? I'd just like to know how effective this is likely to be, the EPR. So for instance, would there be a cost factored into the price of the product and then you could return the packaging or the plastic and receive a refund like we do with bottles? Something to that effect. I know in Germany they have machines in their supermarkets where you can take your plastics, feed them into the machine, and then you get a refund. So I just want to know what sort of research we've done on how we can really make sure that our EPR is very effective, since we are sitting with a plastics crisis. And I know that as a country we only recycle, I think it's less than 50% of our plastics. And then also in terms of the plastics regulations, we talk about the flat plastic bags and the carrier bags. But what about straws? This is just as environmentally hazardous. And plastic microbeads in cosmetics, plastic utensils, plastic cups, styrofoam containers, diapers. I recently went on an oversight in Ungeni, and the river is packed full of used diapers, mountains of it, and it's leaching into the water and it goes into the Midmar Dam, where we have lots of, huge tourist events, and it's very important for local tourism. So we have a huge problem here, and I'm just wondering how we're going to address those broader plastic pollutants and other pollutants, and whether we can be stricter on the deadline, and what EPR perhaps models or plans we're looking at. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, no other member?
Mr. Chair Lorimer.
Okay. Honorable Lorimer, yes.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just a point of explanation and slide 9, talking on about the phase-out schedule of carrier bags and plastic flat bags. What does it mean when it says they must be made from a minimum of 50% recyclate? Does that mean across the production in the company? Or does that mean you want an individual bag must be 50% recyclable? Because there doesn't seem to be much point, because then the bag is just simply not recyclable. Could you just clarify that for me, please? Thank you.
Okay. Any other member? Okay. Honorable Minister.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and thank you very much to the members that have asked questions. Let me start with the issue of diapers, Honourable Winkler. Diapers would not definitely have plastic products in them, but they also have a number of other products which are super absorbent of moisture. And we have actually put up a task team under our environmental programs to look into what can we do with used diapers. There have been some interesting pilot programs where the content, the microgranules that are moisture absorbent are being used for agricultural purposes to enhance soil absorbency. So this is work that we are doing at the moment. So it doesn't fall directly under the plastics stream, because a diaper is a mixed waste product. But we agree with you that we are very concerned about the presence of these products in our water channels more especially on our wetlands, because obviously if you do have these products covering the wetlands, then it undermines the ecosystem services that the wetlands are performing. So this particular product is something that we're engaged in further research on, and in due course we would be in a position to brief the committee. With regard to microbeads, we're working on that with the Department of Health, because microbeads are in products like shampoos and cosmetics and so on. And we are working with the Department of Health to phase these out of the system. It's not something that is directly under our control. Now, I think that you have spoken about the fact that we're working with the industry. Let me tell you why we're working with the industry. We have a big plastics industry in this country, and it's a big employer of people. And I think under current circumstances, we are not in a position to put all of those people out of work. I think there are enough people in this country who have lost their jobs as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic. What we are trying to ensure is that between the plastics industry and the Consumer Goods Council, we are introducing into the fast food sector substitution products. So we know that there are already good products in relation to stores, in relation to plastics, in relation to fast food containers, fast food cups, and so on. So we're working with the industry to, over a period of time, remove those products from the product offering of the fast food chains, and introduce products that are biodegradable and do not have the devastating impact on the environment that all of these single-use plastics have. I think that with regard to the issue of an outright ban, I suppose the question that you have to consider is that despite the legislation that was introduced several years ago to control the nature of plastic products and the nature of plastic bags, we found that these regulations were adhered to in some environments. Can I ask you that those who are on telephone services should mute their devices, because we're getting lots of feedback. We can hear them walking around and doing other things, having conversations.
Yeah.
Can we ask them to mute their devices? They do seem to have muted devices. So what I was saying, Honourable Winkler, is that there has always been a situation in our country where some people respect the regulatory system, and other people simply ignore it. And I think that you would agree with me that we probably do not have the mechanism at our disposal at this point in time to enforce a ban. If we had had the mechanism at our disposal to deal with producers who bypass the current plastic bag regulations, I'm sure we would be in a better position at the moment to impose a ban. So I think that really what you've got to think about when you develop mechanisms to control single plastic use is what is the current state of enforcement in general in your country and whether you will be able to implement the decisions that you make. And I think that we have seen that despite the regulations around plastic bags, that those in fact are not enforceable and they're not implemented. So what we are trying to do is another approach, which is based on working with the industry to start to remove all of these commodities from the value chain. And I must say, you asked about the issue of research. I think our department has done an enormous amount of research, but I think Plastics SA and the Consumer Goods Council have also done an enormous amount of research. I was participating in a Source to See program in Mamzantoti 3 weeks ago, and they have a facility there. They call it a ka-ching machine. Essentially, children bring plastic commodities. The machine weighs them. And it then pays these children for those commodities by giving them airtime on their cell phones. So there are a lot of very interesting ways in which the industry is monetizing used plastic so that there is encouragement by the community to return these goods. You would know that one of the big beverage makers in our country has now introduced a returnable plastic bottle, and it works exactly the way the old glass bottle used to work. So these are the kinds of innovations that we want to see introduced so that we reuse, we recycle, and obviously we should also have a situation where we are minimizing from the outset that waste. But we want to do it in a way that does not jeopardize jobs, and a way that also allows us to stimulate the recycling industry with regard to the extended producer responsibility under Section 18. Mamakala, maybe you want to clarify the issue of the 50% recyclate in the plastic bags. But I think that if you go into a range of stores, you will see that there are a whole lot of commodities that are no longer packaged in plastic. For example, linen, curtains, all of those products are no longer packaged in plastic. We have a whole range of chain stores that are participating in this program to remove plastic bags altogether from their stores. This is a pilot program we're running, but the intention is to roll it out across the country. So there are lots of initiatives of that sort that are starting to reduce the amount of plastic that we are generating in the first place. Obviously, through this other scheme, we are hoping to increase the amount that we are recycling. Let me hand over to you, Mamakala, to answer some of the other questions.
Thank you, Minister. On the question of what does 50% recyclate mean, it's about the product composition. So the plastic carrier bags currently today on the market, they could be made from a virgin material, meaning material that does not contain waste plastic in terms of its makeup. But now we are with this proposal, we are wanting to ensure that the plastic carrier bags going into the future, to a future where if they are still there, they would be made totally of plastic waste. So this is in line with circular economy to ensure that the products are not designed to just go to landfilling, but they stay longer in the economy, and even we don't encourage the use of resources or mining of oil for generation of other plastic products, but the plastic products that are currently there on the market, they go into the makeup of new materials that are there. And the question on straws from Honorable Winkler and cups and other single-use products, it's covered under this EPR scheme. So all the single-use products, they will be having a collection target as well as recycling a target. Some of the products will not have product composition target recycled because especially the food food related, because there are standards with regard to the makeup of some of these packaging materials that are meant to package food. So there are limitations with regard to those, and hence some of those have been excluded for the initial, or have been proposed to be excluded for the initial years. But all these single-use products are now a part of the proposed EPR scheme, such that they are controlled and there is recycling and the collection thereof is improved. Thank you.
Chairperson, can I request that we be excused now because it's 11 o'clock?
It seems as if we have lost the chairperson.
I was saying thank you very much, Minister and team. At least we are better now poised to engage better on some of these issues and advise and suggest if there's need to do so. But I think we have been clarified in most of the issues that have been raised. Otherwise, thank you very much. You are released if there's no other issue you want to raise yourself.
No, Chair, I think we have finished. Thank you very much.
Okay. The meeting is closed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Um...